This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. This is part two of my discussion with documentary filmmaker Thomas Morgan. In part one, we talked about events that led him from investment banking to filmmaking and his drive to create films that tell a great tale, but also call his audience to action. In part two, we talk about the film industry writ large. How is it evolving? What are some of its challenges? What role do film festivals play in the industry? We then turn to the Asia film industry and Singapore's place in it. But first, I asked him to share with us the story of an extraordinary project that landed him in Beirut.
We're doing this film called Sufra. That's the name of this company. This woman in Beirut, in the midst of all of this chaos around refugees and refugee issues, She has lived in this refugee camp her entire life. Her mother's lived in the same camp her entire life. And so she just decided she wasn't going to live like this anymore.
Which camp is this?
It's called Bir Jel Barajna, south of Beirut. And so...
How big is the camp?
It's 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer. There's about 45,000 people that are in that camp now. And it's Syrian, it's Palestinian, it's Iraqi, it's some Lebanese who have married Palestinians. And so it's kind of a hodgepodge of all of these people who have just kind of... And it's
been there for 60 some odd years, right?
It'll be 69 years this year. So incredible. Incredible. And so we don't really think of refugees in that context. So
and the restrictions, people can't have jobs, they can't work. There are kind of limitations on what they can and can't do within the confines of the camp.
Yeah, basically, what the jobs that they're allowed to have, and again, it's not, I'm not belittling the Lebanese government because they have 4.5 million people in Lebanon before they have 2 million refugees. So you can imagine like how crazy that gets. But you know, they're really only allowed to do jobs. If they can get a work permit, if they can go through the process and get a work permit legally, they can work in agriculture, they can work as general laborers. But because there's so many refugees that nobody's going to go through the process of getting a work permit, it's kind of this black market labor and they pay next to nothing because there's so many. I mean, you can get 5 people to do the job as what one guy would have done before. So this woman just decided, you know, we're not going to live like this. So she went around and found all the other women in the camp and said, what can we do? And they're all like, well, we can cook, right? That's the only thing that any of them did on a regular basis. A lot of them are uneducated. A lot of them are in the same boat that she is and never got a chance to finish high school or finish any school. And so she said, okay, that's what we're going to do. And so she...
So what, cook for who?
Well, she set out to get a microloan, and she got this microloan from this organization out of London, which everybody thought she was crazy even applying for it. And then she went back to all of the NGOs that were trying to help the refugees and said, we don't want your handouts. We want your business. We're going to start a kitchen, and we want to cater for you.
Yeah. And so, how did they get those meals to the NGOs?
Well, a lot of times they would have to take them in taxis. They would have to put them all in the taxis, and a few women would sit with all of the food on their laps, and they had no other way to do it. And so they started doing it, and then this woman, Miriam Shar, is amazing, and she just was like, our food is going to be great. It's going to be perfect because this is the first time a lot of people will know us and know who we are. And we don't want them to think we don't want it to be a charity case.
Yeah. It's not. It's more about sustenance, about the culture, the food, the quality, what it means, how it speaks to those cultures. And there's a myriad, as you pointed out, a myriad of cultures and different cooking cuisines which come to the fore. And there's some wonderful little scenes in your film about discussions around, you know, where does that come from? Syria or...
Right.
Or,
right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. What was crazy is, you know, I mean, they would have, when they first got the equipment, like they would have to time the equipment to be able to turn it inside the oven because it wouldn't cook evenly. So to make it cook properly, they'd have to do this. But they were pulling on these recipes that had just been handed down from generation to generation and never written down. And so they were Syrian, there was Iraqi, there was Lebanese, there was, you know, Palestinian food, and they're all kind of showing each other. And it was a camaraderie of this beautiful... What's really interesting to me is Miriam doesn't cook. So she's just the person, like the idea person that kind of gets it going. And then when we started talking to her, I said, well, you know, what would you hope would come from this film? Like, how do we leave this place better than we found it? And she goes, you know, what we really need is we need a children's center. And we need a children's center inside here. There's so many parents that both are going out and working and these kids are alone. And a lot of these kids, you know, they need some help psychologically because they're kind of living in this strange prison. And, you know, and so on the... after she told us that, we went back to an organization that had helped us fund the end of the orphanage, and I said, "Is there any way you'll fund this children's center inside a refugee camp?" And the guy was like, "Absolutely not. There's no way. He's a temporary place. We're not going to fund that." And he said, he went further. He went back. He spoke to his board members, and he came back and he said, "Well, I talked to him. It's 8-0 against. So you're not gonna get it funded."
So how did you convince them?
So I said, "Well, let us fill out the application." So we filled out the application. One part it asked for architectural drawings, and Miriam just drew the picture herself. Like she just drew a picture of like this is what it would look like, you know, if we had the money, because there is no architectural drawing. Come on. Yeah. And so and then I took a 6-minute clip of all of the stuff that we had up until then, and I put it together and I sent it with the application. I said, "Please just have everybody watch this, and these are the lives that they will change by funding this." And he came back and he said, 8-0.
Yeah.
And I said, "We lost." He goes, "Nope, you're approved. We're funding the center."
So, well, it spoke volumes about the power of film and the power of visuals, right?
Well, and I think, you know, you can say and give all these statistics about people, but as soon as you see them, as soon as you know them, then you're compelled to help. And right. You're like, "I can't. I didn't think it was going to be like this. I thought they were going to be this way, or I thought they were going to be that way." And then you see them, and you're like, "Wow, they're just like me. They're like my mom. They're like my aunt," you know, and then you have to help. So, yeah, it was pretty incredible.
So if you wouldn't mind, I mean, with every film you've made, every documentary film you've made, there's a submission process. And now it's important to get recognized because that's part of the deal. If you can't get recognized, you can't get the funding, and you can't go on and do what you love to do, which make films. How does it work in the U.S. now? What are some of the challenges associated with gaining recognition? And what are your thoughts on the development of the film festival industry in the U.S.?
Well, I think when I first started, like you're a bit naive, right? You just think, "Oh, there's all these festivals." Literally thousands of festivals around the world. And actually, if you've been in this business, there's a whole strategy around festivals. There's a whole kind of gaming around how do you do this? How do you get the best exposure? How do you work with PR to get this? And I was very naive to that. Now, after a few years, right, you become a little more savvy, if you will, but I think you also become a little more jaded about what that looks like and what that means. And so, the true independent filmmaker, the guy who goes out there and bootstraps this thing himself and makes the film and puts something really together that maybe is a really important story to tell, the likelihood of that guy getting recognized for that work is really, really, like, I mean, one in thousands and thousands. And no matter how good the story is, because there's just so much, there's so many people who are trying to tell similar stories.
And it's been liberated in many ways by virtue of the lower cost of technologies. People are using, you know, less expensive. It used to be very expensive camera and equipment you used to have.
Oh, well, you used to have to pay by the footage, right? You'd have to pay. I mean, you're going to do it on 16mm. It was going to be this much. And then you'd have to take it to a proper editor who would have to. And now everything's kind of like streaming. Line DSLR, which is great. I mean, it's great because everybody has access and has the opportunity to tell their story, but it also creates like kind of a glut on the market. And so then so
in effect, are the film festivals a conduit for, because so the number of people entering the business means it's been a requisite increase in the number of film festivals, and therefore you would have thought there would have been enough venue space for all the new product that's coming onto the market.
Well, and I think in some cases that's true. There's new festivals that pop up and they're taking new films and new submissions. But the reality of it is there's still there's a number of festivals that are the most important. If you're going to get distribution, if you're going to get picked up, if you're going to go beyond the festival, you're going to be seen at one of these handful of festivals. And so those are the ones that people push towards. All of the rest of them are after that. So if you get into Sundance, then you can say, "Okay, I'm going to be at Sundance. I'm going to be either at Tribeca or Berlin, depending on what my film is. Then I'm going to be here, here, and here." And then you'll get down to, you know, the lower Sarasota Film Festival or something like that. That will never be your first segue into the market.
And these are commercial. So this is a commercial correlation. So if you get into the top 10, 12, 15, you have a higher probability of then being funded or picked up and then licensed, which is the end game.
Right, right. So those are real markets for films. I think, and the other part of it is too, you will just, even video on demand sales. You will get more sales if you have the laurels from the Sundance Film Festival on your film than you will if you have, say, another film festival that's lesser recognized. No matter how good your film is, they'll just look at it and say, oh, this was Sundance. This has to be good, right? Yeah. Like there's a brand with the festivals.
It's like the gold or silver medals on the labels of wine bottles.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what it's become. But to that extent, then what's happened as well is, you know, is it truly independent anymore? Like, what does that even mean? Like, when I go to a film festival, like, for example, Sundance is one of the premier festivals in the world, and it has been for years and years and years. But it's very difficult as a guy who's kind of not pre-selling his films, who's not going out there and getting funded to tell a particular story, who's funding the stories. And then you go into, like, the first three or four films, and you see HBO Films comes up before the documentary plays. And you're like, wait a second. Like, are they getting in because they're HBO Films, who has 8 films or 9 films or 10 films? Like, and no offense to HBO, right? They're buying these things before they can, before the market, before this gets into a bidding war, maybe at a festival. So, I mean, it's more like
fait accompli. It's kind of done. So why are we here? Because we're supposed to be here screening independent films that have high prospect.
That's exactly right. So at Sundance, if you want to see the real independent films, you go across the street and you go to Slam Dance. Because Slam Dance doesn't have any of that shit, right? And they're always on the back of Sundance and they're like little brother over there, but they're truly independent films. These things are not coming in with any press. They are selected and they are the true independents.
But this isn't the way that Sundance was in the beginning. It really did emerge as this idea of we need venue for great and new up and coming independent filmmakers.
Well, even Robert Redford is upset about the way that Sundance has kind of unfolded over the years, right? It's become very commercial. It's become very much about the sponsors. It's become very much about the venues that people are picking up. HBO has a certain number of films that I think will always get in. Again, no offense, but they go there and they spend money. They go there, they put on a huge party. They go there and, there are presence there that actually attract people to the festival. So it's kind of this weird, it's kind of like politics, right? It's kind of this weird politics that you're like, well, you can't say no because they're also a big part of your festival.
This is Inside Asia, and I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Thomas Morgan. Well, let's bring this back to Asia. Have you attended film festivals in Asia, and what are your thoughts about the development and interest in documentary film making and viewing in Asia?
I have not attended a festival here. I was told that my film could get into the festival in Asia. I was way past the deadline, so I'll preface it by saying, like, somebody said you should submit to, Singapore Film Festival. I was way past the deadline. And so I sent a letter and said, or an email and said, will you consider my film? And they said, well, we'll consider your film if Susan Sarandon will come, which happens all the time, right? This happens all the time. I said, Susan's not coming. Well, your film's not in. So that was my experience with, Asian film festivals. But I think what's also difficult here is it's difficult, especially in Singapore, to bring filmmakers to a place where they're censoring your film, where you have to put your film through censorship. And even if they say, well, we'll give you some leeway for the festival, it's never going to play here if you have certain things in it, right? So I think that in and of itself makes it difficult for people to want to come and kind of be part of that. So getting past that a little bit has been, it's been challenging, but I think it is loosening up. I think there's some opportunities now to tell stories that you maybe wouldn't have been able to tell 10 years ago.
It's almost like I've watched through the years, they test the waters. Like, I remember seeing a film years ago called Saint Jack that was released about early stage 1960s Singapore, and it wasn't the most complimentary of Singapore at the time, which is a pretty rough place before they started to develop and modernize. And they let the film show. It had been banned here for many years, but during the film festival, they let it in. And it was well received, and people were kind of like, well, that's a part of history. We get it. It put it in context. That raised their confidence levels. And then year after year, it seems to get easier. Several years ago, they brought in the New York University Tisch School of the Arts. And they said, you can show any and every film you want. And that's the bubble. As long as it's contained within that site, we're not going to complain about it. But we're not going to have, let anybody and everybody come in. So they were trying to then bring, people into the filmmaking environments because they want to encourage that industry. Right. They're very hot on the idea. But these are kind of getting in the way. And then you add to that this issue of a lot of parents in Singapore, you know, very conventional, very conservative, doctors, lawyers, yes. you know, executives. That's the path to the top. Well, and, you know, trying to encourage your kid to be a documentary filmmaker is not necessarily what you see every day among Singaporean families.
No, no one's making a ton of money. Well, there's a few people making a ton of money being a documentary filmmaker, but not a lot. And I think that's the other part. When I first came here and I would say to people, locals, they would ask what I did for a living. I said, I'm a documentary filmmaker. Oh, your wife must work, right? Like that was their first reaction is, oh, your wife must have a real job.
And she does.
Yeah, yeah, of course, right? Like, but she must have a real job because clearly nobody would do this, right? And I remember having this conversation with a guy and I said, you know, well, if your son was tremendously interested in the arts and like, let's just say he was in a boy band, let's just take One Direction, right? As a boy band and your son was a great singer or a great musician and he was going to allow, you would allow him, instead of going to university, you would allow him to go out and tour with this band and come back afterwards. No, I would not. He has to go to university and then he can go and do that. And I'm like, well, you know, like I was just so like taken back by this conversation. But I think also, right, I think the other thing that has happened here is there is a there's not the level of compassion here that there is in the U.S. I think there's not the level of like it is very much of take care of yourself and don't fall behind. And like people who do fall behind, it's kind of their fault. Mm. So I think that's been and to the credit of Singapore, they've built this amazing place in 51 years. But I think that we have to. Somehow we're trying to, you know, kind of unpack this idea of, hey, there's a whole other world out here, not just Singapore. I mean, there's a whole other world beyond Indonesia. There's a whole other world. So I started teaching this class, and this class is for filmmakers, people who want to be filmmakers, who are interested in film.
Young people.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, high school, university, or maybe just out of university, and they're all the people who, like me, loved film, but maybe their father would never let them do this, or maybe they've dabbled in it a little bit and messed around with it a little bit, or just are fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. And so I started teaching this class, and it's 5 months, and it's five classes for 5 months, and there's these big gaps in which they have to go off and do things, and they have to learn about film, and then at the end they have to produce a film. And what was fascinating to me is the stories that they would find, like the one that I'm just so taken by. There's this story of this girl who found this guy who is the person. If somebody dies here and they don't have next of kin or nobody to take care of him, he has for 31 years, he's taken care of and given proper ceremony to them and their death. But before that, he was this gangster who, you know, was going over to tell the elderly to shut up because it was next to his house and he was hung over. And then while there, he realized how much joy they had had and somebody else came in to do the same thing and he found himself to be the defender of the elderly. And now 31 years later, he's been doing this. And it's just this beautiful.
This is the karmic, retribution is time to pay, payback time. He figures that, was it a moment, an epiphanous moment in his life when he said, I now need to do something to make up for everything I've done prior?
I don't know if it was that or he just found this place in his life where, like he said, like he was telling me, he said, you know, I never finished elementary school, let alone high school. I don't know what PSLE, all of these exams that they talk about. I don't even know what they're talking about. He said, but this is something that's spiritual. It doesn't require me to have a high level of education. I can communicate with people I can soothe people who are on their deathbed. And this is where I'm supposed to be. Like, this is my way of giving back something and being part of something that's well beyond this earth. And like, it's fascinating story.
And this young girl was able to evoke this. She was able to kind of get him to open up and talk about it, where prior he'd kind of led a very private life.
Well, even the guy who was helping me with the class said, oh, he'll never do an interview. Like, he won't do it. Like, he's not really like that kind of guy. And she's like, oh, no, he's already doing it. Like, we're already started. And so, like, that was a great and fascinating story. There's another really funny story about, I didn't even know this existed, like the chicken beauty pageants, which is hilarious.
I don't know about that.
Which is hilarious. There's really chicken beauty pageants, and they bring these chickens out, and there is a plastic surgeon that does work on chickens to make them more beautiful.
This is a Singapore event.
Yeah. So
I've been here 17 years. I never knew about
Singapore,
this.
Singapore, Indonesia, and Malaysia. So these three countries have this Singapore. I mean, I'm honest to God, this is the funniest damn thing you've ever seen. And then there was another one where this girl went to, I can't remember where she went. She went to Malaysia, and there was a brothel there, and she was there doing some work for school, and she started talking to this woman, and this woman was married to someone who owned the brothel. And when she found out that a lot of the women who were there were trafficked there, she left her husband. She said, "It's me or the brothel." And he said, "Well, this is great business." She said, "Okay, I'm leaving."
I think this is the moment when we're being kicked out of the screening room because I do have a showing. So, Thomas, we're going to have to – that was our signal.
Yeah.
We're going to say thank you for spending time with us, and fantastic. And we look forward to future films. You're a wonderful inspiration. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. And thanks for the closing music.
That was my interview with filmmaker and activist Thomas Morgan. Thanks for listening. Before I go, let me leave you with a takeaway, or in local parlance, a bungkus. In Indonesia, it's a term used to describe a wrap or takeaway meal, typically a mashup of fried rice, egg, and a bit of chicken. It all comes folded in a brown paper triangle. Bungkus is an everyman's meal, comfort food that's inexpensive, quick, and delicious. If there were a bungkus for this episode, a tidy takeaway, it might go something like this. Thomas Morgan is more than a filmmaker. He's an astute observer of the human condition with a visionary drive to tell the stories of others in order to make the world a better place. His protagonists are the unwanted, the disenfranchised, the poor, and the outcast. His mission is to levitate his characters from the mean streets of their worlds in order to transport them into our living rooms and our lives. Watch a Thomas Morgan film and feel for a moment the bigotry of our times fall by the wayside. Listen to the stories of his subjects and realize that race, religion, and economic circumstances aside, we're all very much and sometimes surprisingly alike. Through the lens of Morgan's camera, the lives of others become a kind of distant country, which we as the audience can briefly inhabit. In this age of instant downloadable visibility, we're too often presented with a window to the world that feels hazy and even ambiguous. Morgan's work has just the opposite effect. It brings life into sharp focus. He unpacks human stories of suffering and triumph and even improbable friendship. He also asks of his audience the same thing he asks of himself, urging us to do more than to passively absorb the message of the medium. The essential thing for Morgan is seeing it and filming it in a way that results in change. That's not just filmmaking, that's philanthropy, a sublime blend of visual art and action-oriented philanthropy. Until next time, I'm Steve Stein, inviting you each week to come in from the outside on Inside Asia.